Topic session number 9436, Reel 1.
Mr. Robbins, Reel 1. When were you born, Mr. Robbins?
22nd of March, 1916.
And whereabouts was this?
Llanelli.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a railwayman.
How old were you when you left school?
15.
To do what?
I became a shop assistant because I couldn't get a job in mechanical engineering. I pursued a mechanical technical course for 3 years, and the only job I could get was half a crown a week in the garage, and I refused to take that, and so then I joined the
Navy. Because you thought you'd better
yourself? Oh yes. And of course my mother had 5 children, and my younger brother was due to go to college then. I thought I would better get out of the house to give him a free run. Money was tight.
Was it easy getting into the Navy?
Fairly easy, yes, but only had to do an arithmetical and an English test.
What line of work did you take up in the Navy?
Seamanship line. You had an option of either becoming a seaman boy or a WT boy, you know, wireless telegraphy. And although I volunteered for wireless telegraphy, I was guided to become a seamanship boy, as the scope for advancement was better in that branch. They turned out to be right because I was recommended for a commissioned rank before I left the training ship.
Did you get it?
No.
Why not?
My eyesight failed. I passed professionally for commissioned rank when I was 18, and they said I was too young. So I sat again the following year and passed and was accepted at the age of 19. And then later on, when I got my educational certificates, I went to the Bermuda doctors, and my eyes had failed. I failed the Board of Trade test.
This was short-sightedness, was it?
That's right. Well, it was astigmatism more than anything.
When did you join the Exeter?
I joined the Exeter in September 1933.
What kind of a ship was she to serve on?
She was a marvellous ship to serve on. Ship's company were great. The officers were very, very good. And everything was put in my way to advance. I was given every opportunity. I never regretted one day I served on the Exeter at all.
Was she a very seaworthy ship?
Yes. Yes, very good. Very good in the seaway.
And what about comfort for the crew?
Well, that left a lot to be desired, really, because there were nearly 600 of us aboard there in mess decks. Very little room to move. But everybody had a place to sleep, and everybody had a place to eat, and that's all that we said. The food was good. It was what they call general messing, where the food was provided and cooked for you. You had no choice. But it was good food.
Did you not have any complaints at all about the Exeter?
No, I can't say I'd have any complaints at all. And certainly comparing it with today's Navy, I certainly wouldn't complain.
Why do you say that?
Well, I paid a visit to the modern Exeter earlier this year, and the amount of room they have to move around in is sadly lacking, in my opinion. They didn't have quarter as much room as we had for exercises and things like that. And everything's below decks there, very little above decks.
What was your action station?
Well, it varied. When I went first, I was a communication number in the director control tower. But for the last commission, that's from 1936 to 1939, I was on the left gun of A turret as number two, which is a breech worker.
What did it involve?
It involved... Let me start. I'll start with the breech open. When the breech was open, I had to rime out the vent to clear out any debris there, cool it down by putting a wash over the mushroom head, which went in the breech, unmask the vent where a tube went in, the firing tube, and then mask that vent. And when all that was done, I put my hand up to tell the gun layer that I was ready for the gun to be moved. He couldn't do anything. And I'd pull a lever called number 21 on interlock. He couldn't move the gun until I had done this. It was a safety arrangement to save a flashback into the turret.
And this was your action station during the Battle of the River Clarge, was it?
No, I'd been moved from the left of A turret to the left of Y turret 6 weeks before the action. Now, no reason was given me for moving. None at all.
Was it usual to give a reason?
Well, it was in that case, considering I'd served at A turret for 3 years completely, and then suddenly moved from one end of the ship to the other when there was no need for it, in my opinion. And the result was I lived through the action, but the man who relieved me in A turret was killed.
What did you assume was the reason for being moved?
Well, I was assumed it was to help the gunner's mate in the turret because he was slightly deaf. I was a petty officer at the time, and they probably considered that the extra substantive rating there would help the discipline in the turret. That's the only reason I can think of.
How did you find discipline in Y turret?
Very, very good. All right. It might have been that their output wasn't good. Certainly A turret were the best turret in the ship, and they thought they might have improved their output of shells fired by putting me there. I don't know. I can never get to the bottom of it.
Can you remember the names of the people who were in Y turret with you during the action?
Oh, no, I... the gunner's mate was... No, I can't remember. It wasn't Nichols. No, a man called Edwards was there, and a man called Trott, Able Seaman Trott. They're the only two I can remember at the time, really. A lot of water's flowed under the bridge.
Now, can we go on to the outbreak of war, and can you tell me what your reaction was when you heard we were at war with Germany?
My reaction was one of quiet excitement. And it was fulfilling my thoughts that we had to do something against Hitler.
What did you feel about the Nazi regime?
I thought it was a horrible regime, and somebody had to do something about it sometime.
Was there anything specifically which had led you to that opinion?
Just the bow-breeding of the minority people.
So you weren't dismayed when you heard we were at war?
No. No. I didn't want war, but I didn't mind fighting it.
Was that how your shipmates reacted?
I would say a majority acted like that.
Did you feel confident that the Royal Navy could handle the German Navy?
Yes, I did.
Now, can we go on to the hunt for the German pocket battleship?
Yes.
In the South Atlantic?
Yes.
In 1939? And can you tell me, step by step, what you recollect of that?
Well, when we sailed from England, we went to Freetown, where we unloaded a lot of unnecessary gear, and when we made our way over to South America, where we patrolled outside the River Plate area for about 6 weeks, We refuelled at sea and restored, we had no ammunition to replace. And then suddenly we paid a visit to Falklands for a quick semi-refit, and we came out of there and we found ourselves on our way to South Africa, as Howard said that we would be meeting the Shear, as we thought then, not the Graff's Bay. We thought we were chasing the Shear. And then suddenly, when we were halfway across the Atlantic, we turned back, and the night before the action, on December the 12th, we were told over the loudspeakers that Howard expected to meet the Graff's Bay on the morning of the 13th of December. And this is exactly what happened.
What was the atmosphere on the ship when you heard that?
Quite excitement. We rehearsed the action the night before.
In what way?
Well, we were told that the Exeter would be going on one side of the Shear, and the Ajax and Achilles would attack from the other side, what they call the AK line in gunnery, and we would be sacrificed while the Ajax and Achilles got into position.
What is the AK line?
Well, when you're either side of your enemy's quarter, ships either side on the quarter.
Was there any fear?
No fear at all. We thought. Well, we've been told we've had subs chasing us, and goodness knows what, and nothing had happened. We thought this was another pie in the sky effort. And I remember sitting down at night to just breaking the interceptor for the firing, alleged firing, you know, the pseudo firing we were practicing, and that was that. In the following morning, when we closed up at dawn action stations, we always did that every morning, and we had cleared that and gone back to our bunks. Those who were off watch were sent back to the bunks, you know, to relax. And I'd no sooner got into my hammock when the alarm bells rang, and we had to rush away to serve the Exeter then, because the Graff's Bay had been sighted.
What happened when you got to your action station?
We got the guns ready and just waited a few minutes. We heard the shells from the Graff's Bay fall around us, and then we opened fire. And it was a great relief when we opened fire. And after that, I remember nothing except serving the gun all the time. There were crashes all around us as the shells were hitting us, but I didn't think of them as shells being as hitting us, just something that was falling down. When we went off the board, our electricity broke down. We were sitting around, waiting around, doing nothing. They sent in a couple of reliefs into the turret to relieve the number twos, because we had very fiddly jobs to do. And we were given help with the washout spray to make it easier for the number twos of the guns.
Did the work go smoothly during the action?
Very, very smoothly. We didn't miss a round, except when the turret went off the board, as it called. We had some slight flooding down below. And there was a pause in the firing, during which times Captain Bell decided to ram the Graff's Bay, and he actually gave the order to bring the ship around to ram. And a couple of minutes after he'd given the order, we got our emergency circuits going, and we were on firing again.
You say flooding. Did water come into your turret?
No, down below, into the lower chambers. Of course, we had a 16-degree list on then, you see.
Could you sense the list?
We could. I could, yes. But it didn't feel very much in the turret.
Was any damage done close by to you?
Yes, the mainmast was half brought down. The sea boats were wrecked around us. But there were only shrapnel marks on the gunhouse itself. And the deck was slightly gouged with shrapnel. We had no direct hit near us.
So there was no sense of fear on your part during the action?
No, none at all. The only sense I had was one of extreme thirst. And during the lull, they sent us round drinks, which was mostly milk, which I couldn't drink anyway. I hated milk.
So you didn't drink it?
I didn't drink it, no. And another amusing incident, I don't know if you can cut this out if you wish.
No, we can leave it in.
During the night, of course, buckets were in the gun house for the gun's crew to urinate in, because you couldn't leave your quarters. And this was got filled during the night, and there would be no time to empty it between the dawn action stations and the action. Result was that the bucket was full. Well, when the young relief boy was sent, ordinary seaman was sent to help me with my apparatus around the breech, every time he washed the breech out, he put the washout squirt in the bucket. And every time he brought it out to do the fresh one, he scooped urine over me. So I was quite smelly when we came out of the turret, believe me.
You were cursing him, were you?
Oh, yes, in a friendly sort of way.
How long did the action go on for as you were concerned?
Well, I would say it started around, it must have been about 6:15. And as far as I can recollect, we came out of the turret after 9:00. But I'm led to understand by the books I've read, it was nowhere near that time that the actual action took place. But then I'm thinking of the time when the Graf's Bay was just a smoke on the horizon when I went in the turret, and she was smoke on the horizon when I came out. Finally.
So it seemed an awful long time to you?
It seemed an awful long time to me, yes.
Was it much of a strain?
No. No, I didn't find much of a strain at all.
So you weren't all tired at the end of it?
No, not physically or mentally.
Do you know how many rounds the turret sent off?
No idea. No idea.
Would it have been dozens?
Oh, yes. Would have been dozens. We could work up a rate of fire of 10 a minute. In A turret, anyway. So I'm sure we could do eight a minute in Y turret.
Were you receiving information about the course of the battle over the tannoy?
No. No.
Didn't you get any information at all during the battle as to what was going on?
No, none at all. No, when I came out of the turret, when we were released and said we could fall out from our action stations, I was amazed at the amount of damage that had been done to the turret, to the ship. Fires were still burning too.
Can you describe what the damage looked like as you emerged?
It looked like a burned out warehouse. Hoses everywhere leaking, wounded still lying around, getting wet as well. It was chaos, really. It was ordered chaos. Men were still working on the fires and damping down, clearing up, putting wounded at their ease and things like this. It's fantastic.
Where had the shells hit?
Mostly amidships, and a couple in the forecastle. One had hit A turret directly. One had hit B turret directly. One had landed on the bridge. One had passed right through the sick bay and exploded outside. Others had fallen in amidships and burned out the midship section of the ship. All my clothes were burned.
So you lost all your property, didn't you?
All my property, yes. All I had were the dungarees or the overalls we'd used in the turret. That's all I had left.
Was that replaced by the Navy?
Oh, yes.
Were you horrified by what you saw?
No, not really horrified, but astonished more than horrified. Once I knew we'd been hit, I thought, well, the damage was not as severe as I thought it might have been, because there were holes we could see, trace, shells had passed right through us, where there was no armour.
At that time, did people feel that there was a danger of the ship sinking?
None at all. None at all. The only time we felt that, at least I felt it, was on our way home when we were in the western approaches, when we approached England in a gale. And with the midship section burned right out, there was no strength there, and there was horrible creaking, and you could feel the ship hogging and sagging. But we came through it.
Was there much of a smell when you came out of the terrace?
Oh, yes. Burned smell. Everything burned. And even the mess decks and, well, until we, after we arrived in Falklands, we were eating from charred tables and things. And that was another great thing after the accident. There was no water. The condensers had been damaged, and we had to conserve all the water we could for the wounded. And I remember washing my hands the end of the day in a bucket with about 3 inches of water in it, and there was broken glass in the bottom of that water. It was the only water available for washing, and about 50 people used it.
Were any of your friends amongst the casualties?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Who specifically?
Well, a petty officer called Dove, Billy Dove. Another able seaman called Richards, able seaman Richards. They are the two main ones, I would say.
Can you remember the burial of the dead?
Yes, I remember wrapping up a naval seaman called Hill, who was a magician. I remember wrapping him up, and he died from a small puncture wound in the groin. But we buried so many on the way down who survived the action and died of their wounds. They're the ones I remember being buried. I don't remember the main, those who were killed in the action being buried. I was probably busy doing something else, you see.
What job did you say Hill did?
Hill was a magician in our concert party. He was a grand chap.
Was there some nervousness about whether the ship would make it to the Falkland Islands?
No. No. And everyone set to after the action, all the seamen at least, went around patching up all the small holes possible so we could get a good blackout at night. We still kept the ship going, you see, in watches, and the off-watch people were working, getting everything ship-shape as possible. And tending the wounded, of course, because the sick bay attendants had to have help with the.
What was your own personal job during that voyage?
My own personal job was to regulate the ship. I was in charge of regulating the seamen from the commander's office, and I helped the senior gunner's mate surviving, Petty Officer Nichols. We sat down in the waist and we organised the ship's company, the two watches, immediately, on the grounds of basis, and that's non-sub rank, and their substantive ranks. And we divided the ship in two like that and organised it, wrote the watch bills out. That's what I was concerned with all the way down.
What was crew morale like after the battle?
Wonderful. Wonderful. Great cohesion. There were no lines of demarcation. Everybody did what had to be done, no matter where it was and what it was.
How long did it take you to get to the Falklands?
Oh, 2 days, I think. I would say 2 days, 2 nights. I think, I'm not certain. But I will say this about the Falkland Islanders when we got there, how they rallied round. And I can honestly say that no man aboard that ship was denied a home in the Falklands. They were waiting on the jetty to meet our men as they went ashore and offered them homes. I know I was one of the last ones ashore to make certain everybody else had gone, and I was met and taken home, and I know I slept for quite 24 hours because I made a little sleep in between, and they looked after me wonderfully well.
Can you remember the name of the people with whom you stayed?
Yes, Mr. and Mrs. Biggs. I've been in touch with them quite recently. The daughter married a superintendent of the Metropolitan Police, or a man who became superintendent in the police.
What did they do for a living? Farmers?
Oh, I think Mr. Biggs I really don't know what he did. I know the sons became seamen afterwards. They both met tragic ends.
In what way?
One was drowned and the other was killed in a motorcycle accident.
What did you do whilst you were in the Falklands after you had had your rest?
What did we do? Aboard?
What did you personally do?
Oh, as far as I know, just run of the scheme, work on the ship. As a petty officer seaman, I ran my office, organising things, and then helped wherever I was needed. There was so little for me to do, really, specifically.
Did people have a chance to look around the Falklands?
Oh, no, there's nothing. There's only Port Stanley, that's all. That was there for us.
Were you keeping track of what was happening to the Graf Spee?
We were kept informed there by radio, ordinary radio, in the people's homes. That's where we heard that the Graf Spee had scuttled herself. It was on the local radio.
How did people react when they heard about the scuttle?
Oh, completely chuffed, really bucked up about it. They cheered and really made a great fuss of us at the time.
Can you describe the voyage home?
When we left Falklands, we left alone. There was nothing in our minds to make us worried about anything. We were told we were going to be met somewhere around Freetown. We were met by Force H, who escorted us up towards the western approaches, where they left us. And then again, when we were in the western approaches, we were escorted again into Plymouth by naval units.
What kind of a reception did you get in Plymouth?
A wonderful reception. People crowded the hold and all round to where we were finally berthed, where the Exeter was built. They had a huge sign up, "Exeter, you were built here." And all the workmen were crowding, cheering. It was a fantastic welcome. And then came the hard part of it. That was the organising of the marches through Plymouth and London.
Why was that so hard?
Well, it devolved on me mostly, and I couldn't leave myself out of it. Although I tried my best, because I didn't want to march through Plymouth or London, but we all had to go. And we had uniform coats issued to us, so we'd all look alike.
Why did you not want to march?
Well, I didn't. I was never one for pretentiousness.
Why was it difficult to organise?
Well, a few had to be left on the ship to keep the ship going. Yeah, I had to decide who would stay. See, that's the problem.
Did the crew want to stay on the ship or go on the march?
Oh, most of them wanted to stay on the ship. They didn't want to march.
Was it embarrassing?
Well, yes, it was embarrassing, really. But once we were there and doing it, it wasn't too bad at all. And it was great for the people to have something to cheer at that particular time. And the reception we got in the Guildhall, London, was marvellous.
Why was that?
Well, they gave us luncheon there. And the words that were said by Anthony Eden, Mr. Churchill, made us very proud of ourselves.
Were you and your shipmates surprised at the reception you got in Britain?
Yeah, yes, we were. We thought we had just done our job. We'd fought a battle, we'd won it. And that we thought that was the end of it. But when the march through London, which incorporated a parade on Horse Guards Parade, where many medals were awarded, we felt very, very proud then.
Now, I think later you were also involved in action on another ship in the Aegean Sea.
Oh, on HMS Beaver, yes.
What kind of a ship was Beaver?
She was a Hun-class destroyer with four 4-inch guns.
How did she compare to be a member of the crew on to Exeter?
Oh, didn't compare at all, really. We had a wonderful captain, we had a couple of wonderful officers, but we also had a number of RNBR officers who were not, in my opinion, too good.
You mean they weren't as competent? Or?
That's right, they weren't as competent.
In what areas did their lack of competence show up?
Well, at the beginning, in lack of seamanship. We taught them all the seamanship they knew, and in gunnery. I was given the task of analysing all the gunnery shoots that the Beaver did when it wasn't in my line to do. I wasn't taught how to do it. I had to find out how to analyse. But that was up to the gunnery officer, who was an RMBR man. And there were things like this.